Thank you. Good idea.
Mr. Co-Chair, I haven't seen you yet this morning.
Yeah, yeah, you have.
Since 5:30.
That was my double.
Please call the roll.
Senator Dockstetter. Senator Hastert.
Here.
Senator Meyer.
Excused.
Senator Perkins.
Here.
Representative Burkhart.
Here.
Representative Esquivel.
Here.
Representative Moniz.
Here.
Representative Nicholas.
Here.
Representative Stubson. Representative Wallace.
Here.
Co-Chairman Harshman.
Here.
Chairman Bebout.
Here.
Mr. Chairman, you have a quorum.
Okay. Anybody in the committee have anything you want to say before we get started? Okay. Good morning. Welcome. Floor is yours. You know the drill.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee. My name is Diane Lozano, and I'm the State Public Defender. With me today is Brian Young, the Director of Administrative Services. He's our Fiscal Director. And directly behind me is Ryan Roden, Deputy State Public Defender. As you already know, the Public Defender's Office has two units. One, the biggest portion of our budget and the biggest portion of our agency is the Public Defender's Office. We are appointed to represent the indigent, accused, and misdemeanors and felonies throughout the state. We also have the Guardian Ad Litem program since 2008, and we provide best interest representation to children in child protection cases. We have limited appearances in delinquency roles. We do appeals, and the termination of parental rights trials are also being handled by the Guardian Ad Litem program. Mr. Chair, did the committee want me to go through our budget reduction plan?
Please do.
Okay. Our total plan and recommendation to the governor and to Joint Judiciary was for a total amount of $984,054. Joint Judiciary went ahead with that recommendation. However, Governor Meade recommended less of a cut, primarily with the Guardian Ad Litem program. First, I'd like to handle the Public Defender's Office. The Public Defender's Office is 85% funded by the general fund and 15% of our budget is paid by the counties, and there's a formula within the Public Defender Act that determines how much each county pays, and we bill them annually for that amount. Our proposal is $689,300 out of our 900 series, which is general funded. We would also lose $135,000 from the counties because obviously that's an amount that we can't bill them. Almost that entire amount is going to come out of what our 900 series, and our 900 series is where we pay our contract attorneys and conflict attorneys and expert services. Expert services can include anything from an interpreter up to an investigator in a case, maybe an accident reconstructionist, DNA experts, and probably the biggest portion of our expert costs are mental health experts. We also have contract attorneys who we sign professional services contracts with in each of our field offices for the entire biennium. Our proposed plan was looking at our caseloads that we would not offer contracts to four different attorneys throughout the state to help us, in essence, save up for that amount in our 900 series. So we cut contracts in four of our field offices, and based on our caseloads, we felt like that was a decrease in FTE that we could handle. The rest of that amount, it would be about $80,000, is an amount that we could not provide to our attorneys in cases where they felt they were constitutionally mandated or in need of expert services. However, in regard to that portion of our budget, we believe our plan is one that we can handle through fiscal year 2014. And certainly, we know we have to maybe expect a further reduction in the next biennium, and we can answer questions about that if any members of the committee have questions in that regard. With the Guardian Ad Litem program, the total budget cut was $189,519. The Guardian Ad Litem program is 75% funded by the general fund, and then we bill the counties for 25% of the costs we spend in their counties every year. So it's a 75-25% split. So there was a small portion of that money that we would not be able to bill the counties for. Governor Mead was concerned that $82,500 of that cut was for training purposes. We participate in the Children's Justice Conference that's put on by the Children's Justice Project every year. They get a federal grant for that conference, and we provide their match, so to speak. So we wouldn't be able to help them have that conference, and that conference would not occur. We also provide training to our attorneys. We try to once a year, usually in a central location. Our director also travels around and provides one-on-one training and specific topic training to our attorneys. So Governor Mead was concerned that we would not be able to provide that training to our attorneys, and as this committee is aware, training, of course, keeps our attorneys competent in their field, and when we're dealing with kids who have been harmed, kids who have been taken out of the home, that training is fairly necessary. The rest of that budget reduction is travel. We have to reduce our attorney's ability to travel within state to meet with kids, to go to court, and then certainly if there's out-of-state travel, we have some kids placed in Utah and Montana and our surrounding states, Colorado, and so our attorneys will not be reimbursed to travel to visit those kids. So that, in essence, is our 8% standard budget reduction plan.
Okay, Senator Perkins or Representative Nicholas, these are your budgets. Do either one of you have any questions?
Sure.
Turn your mic on, Drew, please.
Going back immediately, if we can talk about out-of-home, there are out-of-state placements. Can you elaborate on what are the circumstances that we're having out-of-state placements these days?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Perkins, unfortunately, I'm not really an expert too much in the Guardian Ad Litem program. Stacey Obrecht, our director, was unable to make it today. But I can tell you that out-of-home placements have gone down substantially. But when a child is placed out of the home, it's after other alternatives have failed. We have kids in psychological residential treatment facilities. Generally, there's, I would guess, an underlying pretty substantial condition.
And I guess, Mr. Chairman, my question, I understand that. And we've all worked really hard, both the legislature and in the agencies, to reduce those out-of-home placements. But at this time, why are we still placing kids out of state?
Mr. Chair and Senator Perkins, I don't know that I have a solid answer for you. My guess is that we might not have the resources, but I can find out.
Yeah, if you can find out, and that's fine. If you let us know here in the next few days, we'd appreciate it. Just get us that information. I know we've done that, and we've expended substantial resources on out-of-home placements, and I know we've made substantial reductions. And I know that we've also been looking at the fact that in order to be compliant with some statutes that judges aren't supposed to be placing them in specific institutions, and I think we're starting to get a handle on that as well. But we need to keep working forward on that. The other thing on the training and travel, I mean, ultimately when you've gone back and eliminated your training and travel, certainly you can do that you might get by with that for a year or two, but as we move forward, I mean, we're looking at a situation where our revenues are going to be flat over the next while. We're not going to be looking at expanding budgets. In fact, we're going to be looking get these budgets contracted a little bit, and then we're going to have to try and hold them as best we can. And so ultimately, as we look at travel and training, you may not have that answer today, but ultimately, you might not be able to train for a year, a year and a half, but at some point you've got to get back into the training game because people have to stay competent enough to date. So how do you have any plans or ideas about how you might manage that going forward?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Perkins, I would agree that we could probably handle not training for a year or two. However, our rules and regulations that we promulgated require that our attorneys receive 5 to 10 hours of continuing legal education to stay certified to do guardian ad litem work. You know, our plan now is to utilize video conferencing and do some training that way, to utilize our technology to help with training. But other than that, I'm concerned about it as well. I would also point out that the Guardian Ad Litem program also was cut by $500,000 in the 2010 budget year reduction that Governor Friedenthal had us do. So really this budget is functioning at about 25 less than it was when we received the program in 2008.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The other thing I had to ask, I was going back to your priorities. You were talking about tracking caseloads. Can you tell us what is going on with your caseloads?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Perkins, in both Guardian Ad Litem and Public Defender.
Yes, please.
Senator Perkins, we have in-house database programs where we track our caseloads on both sides of the program. Currently, the Guardian Ad Litem program is working with ETS to do more of a case management program because we have several contract attorneys still. So we annually look at our caseloads. I'm able to look at our caseloads every day, and sometimes I look at them every day, but certainly once a week. The Guardian Ad Litem program, our caseloads right now, last fiscal year we represented 2,010 children, and we had 743 new cases. That's an increase of about 5% in caseload since we received the program. But since the program started in the Supreme Court in 2005, there's about a 55% increase in caseloads there. The public defender caseloads last fiscal year were 13,194 cases. About 70% of those are misdemeanors. That averages up to about 260 new cases per attorney per year, and that represents about a 19% increase since 2004.
We had the prosecutors in here yesterday. Most of them said that their caseloads have been relatively flat over the last few years. So what does that mean, that the number of cases where we're having public defender involvement is increasing over what it used to be?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Perkins, our caseloads the last couple of years have flattened, but since 2004 there's that increase. I would say in the last 2 or 3 years we've held fairly steady on caseloads, but still at about 13,500 cases. Yes, our representation has increased. We track that every year with the Supreme Court and their statistics. We went from 82% to 86% of representing criminal defendants who have lawyers.
So 86% of all criminal defendants who have lawyers are now represented by the public defender's office.
If their cases start in circuit court, we don't handle city or federal cases, but yes.
Did you want to handle city? No, I'm kidding.
Keeps us working.
Okay, thank you. That's all I have, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Nicholas.
Thank you. Just a couple questions. Could you tell us, Director Lozano, would you compare the average or typical wage for the public defenders versus the attorney generals, and how have you balanced those scales? What do they look like?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Nicholas, we are on the same salary classification scheme as the attorney general attorneys. I would guess that we're that we probably are pretty close to parity in that regard.
So that's different than when I was in the attorney general's office. That's something that they brought them up under the Hays study or for other mechanisms.
That's correct.
Can you tell us what is the looks like you have 75 full-time employees and 19 part-time employees. What was it 10 years ago or in the recent past, or how has it changed?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nicholas, at least since I've been the director in 2007, that really hasn't changed a lot. We've added two attorneys to the public defender side and one legal assistant. Probably since 2000, and I could direct this question to Mr. Young, if he might have better statistics than I would. I would guess that we had grown pretty substantially since the year 2000.
What was the overall effect of the addition of the GAL program in terms of number of employee or attorneys and other employees in your office?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nicholas, we have three administrative staff in the Guardian Ad Litem program, and we have 6 full-time attorneys. We started out with 105 independent contract attorneys throughout the state, and we're down to 34 of those.
What programs do you look at or to review in terms of the GAL to try to streamline it? Or you know, my experience just from an outside looking in is that it's a very intensive, very expensive, very time-consuming project. Do you have some type of an evaluative process to try to streamline it or to limit your funding and your ability to accomplish the same thing with limited resources?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nicholas, we do. When we first received the program, we actually got it in March of 2008, and we had to do rules and regulations. So we did a fair amount of study into how they do things nationally. We looked at other states. Colorado in particular had a similar program. We limited our caseloads. Full-time attorneys can only handle 80 cases, which means 80 children. Most of our attorneys, though, are fairly under that standard. We provide, especially through Stacey Obrecht, our director, constant information. We have a website that has resources. We work well with DFS. Each community has their own little sort of team that handles these kids, so I think that helps us streamline our cases. Caseload-wise, we're not in any area of concern with the Guardian Ad Litem program at this point in time.
Tell us a little bit, if you would, please, about the longevity of your employees. I mean, what's your turnover rate for both staff and for attorneys in the office?
Mr. Chairman, if I could maybe have a second to ask Mr. Young if he has some information on that. Okay, I guess not. Representative Nicholas. I would say that our attorneys on the public defender side stay with us, and this is anecdotally, and we could go look on an average of 5 years. We've got, 5 to 10 attorneys who have been with us for 10, 15 years. We hold pretty steady with the guardian or with the attorneys on the public defender side. And the staff, the turnover rate is even less than that as far as our legal assistants and our investigators. We've only had the Guardian Ad Litem program since 2008, but, we have the same set of attorneys who are dedicated to this work who have stayed with us. We only have 3 administrative staff in the Guardian Ad Litem program. We don't have legal assistants, so.
And then finally, in some of the Supreme Court decisions we see on criminal appeals, there's some language that is always sometimes not too kind about the arguments that are being raised from the public defender's office, and knowing that you have mandatory appeals and that you have to do it. How do you address that issue with your staff in terms of work productivity, in terms of the arguments raised, and getting the biggest bang for your buck from your office?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nicholas, we have 4 in-house attorneys who handle the appeals. Our chief appellate counsel, Tina Olson, is the director of that program. They meet weekly, if not daily, about what issues to raise. Certainly, because, as you said, our clients have a constitutional right to direct appeal and they have some say about what issues to raise. We try as much as we can not to raise the issues that are going to get us criticized by the Supreme Court. However, I would also say that, the law changes every day. And so sometimes what maybe was not a good issue yesterday might be a better issue next week. In the more serious cases, obviously, too, we have to raise issues to preserve the record for federal habeas or whatnot. But we do have meetings with them. I have meetings with them daily. We read their opinions if we're concerned about issues that were raised or with the Supreme Court. We meet with them. We've also, have a good relationship with the Supreme Court. If there's concerns with the Supreme Court, we are also meeting with them.
What's the status of any funds you have for death penalty county cases or high profile cases?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Nicholas, as the committee has seen, we asked for a supplemental budget of an additional $500,000 in capital cases. Right now we are paying on 3 different capital cases. Capital cases are different in the sense that, of course, as the legal speak is, death is different. If one of our clients receives the death penalty and is ultimately executed, it's the most obviously severe punishment that a government can hand down. What makes those cases different in the sense of funding is that the United States Supreme Court, has adopted the ABA standards in regard to capital case representation. And what is required in a capital case is different than in a regular case. So I have to appoint 2 attorneys to a case. Those 2 attorneys have to be trained. Nationally is where most of the training is. We have to have a fact investigator in each of those cases, and then we have to have what we call a mitigation investigator. And that person's job is to do a thorough and comprehensive investigation into the capital defendant's life story. That's our job, to present to a jury that entire story. So those costs generally are driven because we do not have mitigation specialists, capitally trained mitigation specialists on our staff. So those cases do become a lot different. The governor has recommended, of that $500,000, $200,000. We are also working with the budget office to hopefully repurpose monies that we did not spend out of that special project funding from last budget year. You know, each capital case is different. With it comes different facts of the person's life. For instance, if you have a capital case defendant with mental health issues, there are experts involved in that. We have to make sure our clients are competent. We have to make sure that we don't have a mental health defense. And then mental health, of course, is always a mitigation factor that we have to present, constitutionally speaking, to a jury. I monitor as much as I can the capital case spending that we have. I'm trained to train people to do capital cases. I'm on faculty, so around the country. In fact, I'm supposed to go to San Antonio in February to help train some attorneys down in Texas. So certainly in-house we know what capital cases take and what the fundings are. We are as conservative and responsible as we can within the guidelines, but I can't tell this committee honestly that we won't be back in January with an effective immediate budget, because I don't know what these cases are going to cost us down the road.
And you mentioned earlier in terms of your planning for the biannualized, the cuts that you're having here. Could you just elaborate that on a little bit, please?
Pardon me, could you repeat that?
To biannualize your cuts, or what's your plan if we have to come back with a 4% cut or an 8% cut in the next biennium?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Nicholas, I wish that we could have some control over our caseloads. That would help. I'm glad to hear that the district attorney's office thinks their cases are going down, and hopefully that will reflect on us. Because most of our cuts on the public defender side are within the 900 series, we can do as much as we can without the contract attorneys that we've cut, and see where that takes us. We have an in-house, pretty stringent process where attorneys ask for expert funding. Our deputy, Mr. Roden, is the one who reviews those, and then if there's any questions, we try to provide the training at our annual conference so people understand what they need and when they need it and why. But as far as coming up with a plan, other than really carefully monitoring our caseloads and making sure we're not requesting experts just because we can, I don't know that we can come up with a plan when we don't have control over how many cases we have or what type of cases that we have. And I would say that the same holds true with the Guardian Ad Litem program.
Thanks. That's all I have.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Perkins.
Thank you. One follow-up. Diane, on the Guardian Ad Litem cases, and you said that you've been trying to limit to 80 children. Mm-hmm. Do you differentiate between open cases and active cases in the caseload?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Perkins, on the guardian ad litem side of things, no. You know, as long as it's open, the child, we're representing that child until termination, or DFS has closed the case. So, you know, it's open until the court says that it's not. On the public defender side, we do.
I'm just looking as you allocate your resources. I mean, you can have open cases that there's not any active anything going on. And so I'm just wondering, I mean, is that a rule, or is that a Supreme Court rule, or how do you make that determination?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Perkins, I will tell you that we are working with ETS to come up with more of a case-weighted management program with the Guardian Ad Litem program to help us differentiate between, you know, how much work are we doing on a case and when. We do have a case-weighted program with the Public Defender's Office that helps us in our case assignments, and it helps us determine really where our resources need to be and who's really busy on paper and who actually is really busy. So we're working on coming up with that type of a plan for the Guardian Ad Litem program.
Okay. I think ultimately, I mean, as we allocate resources, that'd be a significant thing for you to look at.
I agree.
Thank you, Diane.
Anything else? Reverend Stubbs.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Ms. Lozano, talking to you just about the public defender side of things, mm-hmm. on the contract attorneys that you use, are those typically the rates that you utilize with the outside contract attorneys? Are those negotiated on a case-by-case basis, or do you have a standard fee that applies to everyone? And have you looked at that as a possible avenue for, addressing some of the budget issues going forward?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Stubson. We generally pay our attorneys, contract attorneys, the same amount. There's a little room for flex. However, the most that we pay hourly to an outside attorney to come in and handle a case is only $50 an hour. And at that rate, when private attorneys tell me that they can make $100 an hour, we have problems getting people to take our cases. However, on the agency side, the independent contractors who work with us, you know, are part of our field offices, so to speak, they make anywhere from $45 to $50 an hour, but we pay them to handle a caseload, so they almost get a salary amount every month. And that can range from $3,900 a month up to $5,700 a month. I think if I were to go to our contract attorney and say I have to pay you less, we would probably lose a large majority of those attorneys.
Can you?
Mr. Chairman, and then on a slightly different subject, as I was looking at your budget proposals and the demands on your office and that sort of thing, I was wondering whether the actions of this committee, the actions of this legislature ever show themselves in arguments of ineffective assistance, and whether you see arguments, you know, the legislature is draining money out of the public defender's office, and so, you know, obviously they can't afford to offer the defense that these folks need. I mean, is that paranoia, or do you see that out there happening?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Perkins, or Stubson, I'm sorry, Representative Stubson, you know, not yet. I think the criticisms or the concerns that we hear and from the judiciary and stakeholders and our clients is that maybe we need to add more attorneys. The busier our attorneys get, the less time they're spending with their clients. And that's when maybe on appeal you see complaints from a client that the attorney, you know, didn't spend 10 hours with him explaining the plea agreement or whatever those standards are. I would tell you that I'm more concerned about the capital case funding. I'm more concerned about our ability to provide representation in those cases because the resource and the funding is so much different. You know, and the conversation we had with Joint Judiciary was that very thing, you know, they were worried that, you know, were we someday going to have to say we couldn't provide adequate assistance to somebody on death row because we didn't have the money.
Okay, anything else? I've got a couple for you, Diane,
okay.
Real quick, like, and then we'll wrap this up. The reductions you make can be biennialized, I believe. Don, is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, mathematically they can be biennialized. It becomes a question of whether or not they can continue to reduce double the amount of outside counsel that they're currently reducing.
Okay. The other, do you have any vacant positions on in your 70, however many employees, are any vacant?
Senator, I believe we have, Mr. Chairman, we have one vacancy, but we're in the middle of negotiating a hire, so.
When you looked at your reduction, did you look at reducing staff?
We did not.
You did not do that?
No.
Okay, as you move forward, if we have the 8% reduction we're talking about, without looking at staff, how do you anticipate doing that? I mean, you can cut the 900 series to a point, but you still have to look at staff. Would you agree?
Mr. Chairman, unfortunately, I do agree with you. You know, as it is, we look at national standards for our caseloads, particularly on the public defender side, and there's a little fancy formula that we've learned to use, and we're right at about 98% of maximum caseloads. You know, my belief is if we were to cut attorneys specifically, that we would get closer to violating constitutional rights and our constitutional mandate in that regard. As far as legal assistance, you know, we have one legal assistant for every two attorneys, and those legal assistants really don't get to help much. They do a lot of administrative work for me. They track cases. They close cases. They send letters. They answer the phones. So, you know, my concern would be with whether or not we could fulfill our statutory and constitutional mandates if we were to go that route.
Okay. Anything else, committee? Thank you.
Thank you.
Commission on Judicial Conduct and Ethics. Patrick. Good morning. We got enough seats there? Okay.
Thank you. Least understood and probably unloved commission or agency in state government. We are not a member or a part of the legislative branch. We are not a part of the executive branch. And we are independent of the judiciary because we are the oversight for the judiciary. In fact, we are the only oversight for the judiciary in the state of Wyoming. Our task and our function is to receive complaints of judicial misconduct. We don't review judges' decisions. We review their ethical and professional conduct, and we impose discipline as may be appropriate. Our composition is three judges appointed by the judges' committees, three lawyers appointed by the State Bar State Bar Association, and six lay members. And I'm pleased to introduce to you three of those lay members, and I'd ask you to stand. Maggie Farrell, who's the current vice chairman and incoming chairman from Laramie, Jim Wilson, the incoming vice chairman from Sheridan Bighorn, and Karen Hayes from here in Cheyenne. We have one employee, and I'll introduce her to you. This is Wendy Soto, who is our executive director, and Wendy runs our show. And Wendy, if you just take a couple of minutes and explain to the panel what you do, how your job works, and your functions.
Certainly. Thank you, Chairman. Good morning. Essentially, I manage the agency. As the executive director, I perform functions of an executive sort of management decisions, clear down to performing the filing. I essentially do all the scheduling. I make decisions about what we're doing with ETS. I have to be aware of personnel. The budget, I prepare the budget and prepare the commission for presentations and help them to understand the budget. I arrange for meetings, manage the docket, our caseload, which is the biggest part of what I do. So essentially, it's the gamut from top to bottom.
So that you understand how our body works, when we receive these complaints, we do 99.9% of our work either by telephone conference call or by email. We are very efficient. We do meet twice a year. I think that's unavoidable. It's essential that we get together someplace in the state as a body twice a year to go over the administrative details of our operation. I've been on the commission, and commissioners are limited to 6 years, and I'm in my sixth year. So historically, when I came on, our budget was, as best I can tell from my records, about $400,000. In 2009, our budget request was $341,000. In 2011, we requested and had approved a budget of $365,000. That budget, of course, was subject to the Herschler cuts. There was a slight increase from 2009 to 2011 because we had a change in executive directors. We had only one executive director in our whole history, and so she retired, and we hired Wendy the past year. And so we budgeted into that budget about a $20,000 increase from the previous budget to accommodate that change in that transition. My understanding is the Joint Judiciary Commission recommended an approximately $9,700 cut from the 100 series and a approximately $5,000 cut from our 900 series, which amounts to an 8% overall cut. I think it's worth noting in this discussion that the Joint Judiciary recommendation for the judiciary, probably the most analogous part of government, was 4%. And so they're asking for us to take an 8% cut, or approximately twice what the judiciary is taking in the way of a cut. In terms of looking at our budget, we believe we can absorb the $9,000 cut in the 100 or personnel series. We would like to ask you to reconsider the cut in the 900 series, and let me explain how that works. We use that money, Mr. Chairman, to hire outside counsel to deal with these disciplinary complaints that we get. If we get a contested, disputed complaint, we might need to hire outside counsel. I will tell you, since I came on the commission, and Wendy's figures that she submitted indicate that our complaints have approximately doubled in my six-year tenure. And I will tell you anecdotally that the complexity of the complaints, the difficulty of the complaints that we've received in the past couple of years have increased. We have a couple of very, very serious complaints pending at this time. Way back before my time, the commission ran out of money to hire outside counsel and to prosecute complaints against judges. And what they had to do was to go to the governor for a supplemental budget increase. And since that time, we have budgeted the 900 series at approximately $108,000. And that's remained level in my whole 6 years with the commission. What happens is we spend that money as frugally as possible, and if we don't spend it all, which is most often the case, it reverts to the general fund. So we don't waste any of that money. We use what we use, and what we don't, we give back. But we have tried to keep that funding level in the 900 series so that we don't have to come back either to this body, to the governor, or somebody to bail us out and provide funding midstream in the middle of a contested judicial proceeding. And so we would ask that you restore that $4,800 to our 900 series when you consider our appropriation. If there are any questions about our budget or our program, we'll be happy to address those.
Thank you. Senator Perkins, or Senator Perkins. Bob, you got any questions?
Yeah, just a few. Could you tell us how much, Mr. Dixon, has been reverted back on a regular basis over the last, since you've been there, in terms of your 900 series?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nicholas, I could not. I can get that data for you. I don't have it at hand.
Do you have an approximation of what it was?
You can.
Let me. Representative.
With your permission.
Go ahead, Wendy.
There you go.
Chairman, Representative Nicholas. I can tell you that we reverted from, hang on just a second, the 2009 budget fiscal year, we reverted about $75,000 back to the general fund from the 900 series.
And your request is to transfer the $9,000 reduction in 100 series to your contract. Is that correct? To your contract funds? So just walk me through on what you would like to do and how that will be biennialized for the following year.
Please, go ahead.
Chairman, Representative Nicholas. How it would be biennialized would be to go ahead and take that $9,700. That figure was for 1 year, so we could take
same,
that
put it at 4%
in the second year. What we're asking is that the $4,800 in the 900 series be restored. We again were requested or directed by the Joint Judiciary Interim Committee to take a 8%. Reduction as opposed to a 4% reduction, which is what the judicial branch. So, of course, we're asking for that 4%, but the $4,800 is, I think, what we're asking.
Where are you officed at?
We are in the Hansen Building.
Okay. And how long have you been there? I'm just recalling past things. It was my understanding that at one time it was housed in someone's house.
Chairman, Senator Nicholas, that is indeed the case. The previous location for the commission was in the home of the previous executive director, who retired at the end of June. Since the 1st of June, we have been in leased space in the Hansen Building on the third floor, where the Paramutual Commission used to be, Suite 300.
And what's, for your position, what's the pay scale for your position? Has it changed from the previous director till now?
It has not. It's at market. It has not changed.
Thank you. That's all the questions I have.
Senator Dockstetter, you had one?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, just quickly, just you're telling us then we have an increased costs, Mr. Dixon, just in the past 6 years. The caseload has doubled, more difficult cases. Just help us understand why.
I don't know that our costs have increased. Our caseload has increased, and I think the complexity has increased, and I don't know that there's any explanation for that. But our judiciary is really in above and beyond. We have an excellent judiciary. We have very few problems. But when we get problems, they tend to be pretty serious. And it's random. We'll go maybe 2-3 years without a real serious complaint, and then, boom, all of a sudden this year in the last couple of months, 2 very serious complaints. I don't know.
Okay, anything else, committee? Representative Stubson.
Mr. Chairman, and Patrick, you were talking about the need to retain outside counsel on complaints. And I was just wondering if you'd talk about, I mean, is that something you do with each complaint, or do you do an initial review and determine whether outside counsel is needed? Or?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Stubson, it's on a case-by-case basis. I would say that 80% of our complaints, probably 75-80% of the complaints are meritless, and we resolve those on our own investigation. From time to time, we get substantive complaints that we can resolve on our own investigation. When it gets to the point where we have to file probable cause charges and do a formal investigation, we hire typically Mark Gifford or Kate Fox, who have a considerable expertise in this area of the law and do an excellent job. They're excellent representatives for our commission.
Okay, anything else? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Corrections. Bob, good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Bob Lampert, Director of the Department of Corrections. Here at the table with me this morning is Steve Lindley, who is the Deputy Director. Immediately behind me is Carp Carpenter, our Business Manager. And to his left is Jeffy Wiggins, who's our Central Services Division Administrator. I'd also like to recognize one of our retirees, Dee Garrison, who's here. Hi, Dee. We appreciate the opportunity to present our supplemental budget. I think the proposals are fairly straightforward and account for an 8% reduction. These are strategic reductions based on, in part, on our operational history and our targeted areas that we believe we can take some calculated risk in order to become more efficient. You might notice I did say calculated risk, and I said that because there's some risk in taking 8% of our agency budget away, particularly in terms of long-term savings that might be realized without those costs or without those cuts. But I'll detail those risks for you as we step through the budget itself. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to take just a couple minutes to give you some background information before we get into the budget itself. First, let me assure you that the Department of Corrections is committed to doing the right thing at the right time and for the right reasons in the most effective and cost-effective manner. And that we are and will continue to be good stewards of the state's dollars. Thanks to the team of dedicated corrections professionals that we have located in our individual field services offices across the state, in our institutions, and in our central office, we continue to deliver correctional services that are among the best in the nation in terms of return on investment. Although it costs more to incarcerate inmates in Wyoming than in most other states, we also continue to enjoy one of the lowest recidivism rates in the nation, and that recidivism rate is the rate of return to prison. At last report, the percentage of people who successfully complete their sentence and do not return to prison for a new felony conviction within 3 years of release is 90.3%. Said another way, less than 10% of inmates and parolees who successfully discharge their sentence return to prison within 3 years of release for a new felony. 75% of the offenders who are released on parole are successful and do not return to prison within 3 years. Of those who do return to prison, many come back as a result of a technical violation of the conditions of supervision and not as a result of a new felony. Similarly, 73% of those who serve a term of felony probation are successful 3 years out from completion of their term of supervision. The highest failure rate occurs among those who are on misdemeanor probation and under our supervision. They're the hardest group to serve and supervise. They tend to have a lot of issues, and their period of supervision is short, so their failure rate is 38%. But even with that group, 6 out of 10 are successful. So you might be wondering, if we're not seeing high levels of recidivism, where are inmates coming from? Well, fortunately or unfortunately, depending on your particular point of view, we continue to have one of the higher incarceration rates per 100 citizens in the nation. This high rate of incarceration, combined with the overall population growth in the state, a trend towards increased sentence lengths, and the number of technical violators we have returning to prison, is why our prison population has stabilized or grown slightly over the past few years, despite our best efforts otherwise. The reason that I'm pointing this out is so that you will better understand the longer-term potential costs of a few of our budget cuts that we are proposing. If you turn to page 9 of the budget document, you'll see our population projections through fiscal year 2015. You can see that our prison population is expected to average 2,225 people in fiscal year 2015, or about 140 more inmates than we had on average this last fiscal year. When we project our population out to fiscal year 2020, we anticipate the population to grow to nearly 2,500 in fiscal year 20 if the current trends continue. What that means is if there is no change in that trajectory due to our own efforts to further reduce recidivism or as a result of policy changes within this body, I would anticipate Wyoming will need to complete construction of the additional 144 beds that were shelled out at the Torrington facility during initial construction, and we would need to do so in the next biennium. I'm guessing that the cost of that additional construction would be around $9 million and would require somewhere around 30 new staff positions. Those would be new staff for the increased male population at Wyoming Medium Correctional Institution in Torrington and the increased female population that's anticipated at the Wyoming Women's Center in Lusk. Although that information doesn't directly affect the current budget proposal, Mr. Chairman, I thought it was important background information as we move forward, and it gives some context to the calculated risk we made in developing our budget reduction proposal. Mr. Chairman, that concludes my introductory comments, and with your permission, I stand ready to move through the budget.
Please do.
If you go backward in our budget document for just a second to page 4, page 4 of our budget document highlights the fact that we're seeking to reduce our biennial budget from $312,195,810 to $299,555,252, and that includes both our proposed 8% reduction and the amount resulting from the total IT consolidation effort. Page 11 of the budget provides the prioritized list of general fund reductions contained in our request, and you'll notice that the lowest priority in that prioritized list has to do with investments in the community in terms of adult community corrections programs and professional services contracts for field services. And the program that's our lowest priority in terms of prison population is a reduction in the substance abuse programs funding. And we'll talk more about that as we get to them. Page 14 of the document details the first of our proposed reductions, and it's in the area of funding for out-of-state housing of inmates, or out-of-facility housing of inmates, excuse me. This is money that is used to house inmates outside of our own facilities due to safety and security concerns. It's also used for high-risk inmates and hard-to-place inmates that are nearing release, and it's also used for other inmates with unique needs. This cost center pays for housing inmates in federal prisons, for example, that are too violent to be housed in our own facilities based on their institutional and criminal histories. It's also used for housing inmates in our local county jails. The amount of the proposed reduction is $1,056,000, which we believe we can safely absorb at this time without a significant risk. Although it would reduce our flexibility to house inmates in facilities other than our own, we're committed to housing Wyoming prisoners in Wyoming prisons first, whenever we can safely do so.
Good morning, Bob. Just to follow up on what you just said, so I take it then that what you would do is instead of sending them out to various out of not the violent ones, but the other ones, are you talking about that you would keep them in prison as opposed to putting them into community alternatives or other types of things?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Perkins, in regards to this particular budget cut, this would affect our placement in county jails for inmates that are hard to place or nearing release. In particular, that we believe would better transition from county jail, where they're closer connected to the community. It would not affect our adult community corrections placement. There's a separate budget reduction proposal for that. Mr. Chairman, so even with the projected increases in our inmate population over the next few years, we would not anticipate a need for increased out-of-facility placement prior to expansion at WMCI. And believe this is a feasible reduction plan. We would therefore request your concurrence with the governor's recommendation. Are there any questions on this particular item? Page 16 is an IT consolidation item, and assuming there's no questions on that, we can move on to page 19. Page 19 identifies a reduction of $586,329 in the area of professional fees. This funding was intended originally for use by our field services or probation and parole supervision team. It's used for purposes related to drug and alcohol testing and for funding our intensive supervision program, or ISP. Through the adoption of best practices and risk-based supervision tactics, we now know that not every offender who's out on probation or parole needs to be tested weekly for drugs and alcohol, and that not every offender risk level requires intensive supervision. We've adopted a risk-based model of supervision that provides the highest level of supervision and highest level of drug testing to those at the highest risk, and reduced need for that at the lower level risk. Therefore, by making those internal adjustments on how to best supervise offenders on a more individualized basis, we've become more efficient in our field service operations and believe we can absorb this budget reduction without any significant negative impact on operations or community safety. We would therefore again request your concurrence on this item. Are there questions on this item?
Keep going.
On page 22, we detail a proposed reduction in the amount of money available to the agency for contracted housing with the three adult community correction centers, or ACCs, in Cheyenne, Gillette, and Casper. Mr. Chairman, Senator Perkins, this addresses your question. The adult community correction centers provide housing and case management services for probationers, parolees, and inmates, as well as Addicted Offender Accountability Act and ISP violators as an alternative to revocation of parole or probation. It also provides us with a transition option for inmates who are preparing for release when they can be housed securely at night and work during the day in the communities where the ACCs are located. This provides for less costly housing of persons who otherwise would be in prison. Based on our actual use of ACC beds, however, and our actual projected needs for ACC placements, we believe we can absorb the $214,593 proposed in this budget reduction with minimal impact to the agency or to our communities. While we have had requests from at least two of the current ACCs to increase the number of beds under contract, this proposal would keep the number of beds the same as what we currently have contracted for, and therefore would not negatively impact their current contract capacity. We would therefore request you concur with the governor's recommendation to accept this budget reduction.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Stubbs.
Thank you. Director Lampert, I'm noted on page 22, you talk about that, you know, one of the impacts of this could be offenders not being sent to the ACCs, and that the cost of keeping them in the prison is three times what it would be. And so it just leads me to question whether this is one of those sort of penny-wise, pound-foolish cuts. Or is this something that is ultimately going to save the state money, or by cutting the number of ACC beds we're using, is that just, increasing budgets elsewhere?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Stubson, again, this is not a cut in the number of contracted beds. It ensures that we cannot increase the number of contracted beds, which has been a request of two of the facilities. Our projected needs were within our contract capacity right now, and that's also been our actual needs, our actual use. In the past, we've contracted for more beds and haven't used them. Over time, this brings us in line with what's not only currently contracted but our historical usage, and we anticipate through the next biennium that it would remain the same.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Meyer, you had your question.
Bob, when we get into next year and we have to make that decision whether we start constructing that 144 beds, could we have an analysis on that construction versus adding money back into the last two areas that we cut, and how that might work in a long-term solution? I know the beds is definitely a long-term solution. But maybe along the context of whether it is less expensive to do it with through the county jail system or through these contractors, and whether or not that would be a long-term solution, just kind of an analysis of the whole thing when we get into it next year.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Meyer, I think perhaps some of the rest of the budget presentation may address some of that. But if it doesn't, certainly anything that you desire we can put together in terms of the current costs and projected costs of each of those options versus the construction.
Well, I'm sure, Mr. Chairman, your analysis, Bob, will be thorough.
Thank you. Senator Perkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Following up on Representative Stubson's question, if I understood what you're saying here about the alternative or the adult community corrections or community alternative centers that we're out here, are you saying that this is an amount that you anticipated would have been an increase in beds, and now you're just going to hold it steady? I'm trying to understand. You're saying this maintains the current level of contracted beds, but yet it still reduces the amount you had available now. I'm just trying to understand where this cut actually happens.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Perkins, we had funding to increase the number of beds. However, we also knew the state of the budget, so we did not contract for those increased beds. We let those ACCs know that any increase that they had requested in terms of the number of beds would be dependent upon the state of the economy and the state of our budget, and therefore we chose not to increase the number of beds at that time, and we've remained within, and the current number of beds remains within our projected use over the next biennium as well.
Please continue.
Mr. Chairman, page 25 is another IT consolidation item, and so I'd move to page 27. Page 27 is the first of five requests to reduce the level of our inmate medical care funding. As I've explained in the past, inmates are the only subset of our state population that has a constitutional right to state-provided medical care. That medical care includes, but isn't limited to, health care, mental health care, pharmacy services, vision services, and dental services, which must all be provided at a constitutional level of care similar to what is provided in the community. Our current medical contract provider is Corizon. Corizon has worked closely with us to control medical costs within the agency, and together we have identified operational efficiencies that have permitted us to level off contract costs. Although the anticipated medical cost rate increase posted by the National Consumer Price Index has been 6% per year on average for medical costs and 8% per year for pharmacy costs, and we budgeted for that anticipated increase, we have instead been able to hold our contract amount steady since 2011 as a result of our partnership with our vendor and some hard negotiations. In this past year, we've modified our contract from 100% risk on the vendor for all off-site costs to a shared 50-50 arrangement between the contractor and us. This was a recommendation which arose as a result of a legislatively funded review of our medical contract and service levels that was based on this committee's recommendation 2 years ago. That study gave us some good ideas, and in implementing some of those ideas, we've been able to better contain the costs of inmate medical care. In addition to the increased efficiency in-house in terms of treatment and contract modification for shared risk, we've worked with the vendor to negotiate better reimbursement rates to the state from hospitals and specialty providers in our communities as well. This has not only resulted in decreased costs of services, but it's also allowed us under current contract to retain as many of those services in-state with Wyoming providers as often as possible. Whereas we once thought we might have to take our business out of state in order to save money, Wyoming vendors have been willing to work with us to get better rates in-state and to retain that business in-state. So it's been a win-win for us and for the vendors. That would not have been possible without the support of the governor's office and his staff, so kudos to him and his staff for their efforts in this as well. Because of the efforts I just outlined, we believe we can reduce our overall medical funding by $6,348,691 without negatively impacting inmate care or operations. I will admit that the sustainability of those reductions beyond fiscal year 14 are hard to predict, as we'll be entering a new biennium and we have to put together a new RFP. So there's always a chance that our contract amount may have to go up, but then again, it could go down. That's the nature of the state procurement process. But with that said, the first portion of the reduced medical funding is a reduction of $1,371,325 in Unit 3051 at the Wyoming Honor Conservation Camp, which again is on page 27. We would therefore request your concurrence with the governor's recommendation, and I would stand for questions related to this item.
Questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Burkhardt.
Mr. Chairman, good morning, Bob. Question, being new on this committee, you talked about the 50-50 shared risk. Would you explain that a little bit, please?
Please.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Burkhardt, back in 2004, we established a contract where whoever provided medical services to inmates was responsible for all medical costs, whether they incurred inside the facility or outside the facility. That kind of contract comes with a premium because the off-site costs are so unpredictable. They could be $100,000 this year and $6 million next year, depending on the critical incidents that occur that require off-site care. Since we've been working with the current vendor, we've figured out ways that we could between working with the contractor and building the facility at Torrington, we can more readily handle most of those cases in-house without having to go outside for specialty care, which has saved us some money. And we've also been able to project and live within a established, I'll have to ask Jeffy if she remembers the amount, but how much for off-site, $3 million on average? We've averaged about $3 to $4 million in off-site costs. So by going to a 50-50 cost share, we're able to, in effect, the vendor would pay half of those off-site costs. We would pay half of them, and the contract budget, the contract amount has come down as a result of that, proportionate to this cost savings. So, in effect, our contracted amount has gone down. We have a reserve for off-site costs that's 50% of the anticipated cost. But it ultimately results in cost savings to us because the total cost for all off-site care has gone down.
Mr. Chairman, a follow-up to that, our 50%, the state's 50% of that, where's that money coming from?
Mr. Chairman, that's still in our medical budget. It's just not in the contracted amount.
Mr. Chairman.
Just a second. Senator Perkins.
Bob, we had talked a little bit about this before, and I don't remember, we just very briefly, but have you looked, and I know you're aware of that, but there's been And I've been contacted by various people talking about we can save costs on medical by, because we have people who may be qualified for Medicare, Medicaid benefits that are in our prison population, so I'm sure that we do. And I think you said you've looked at that, but I'm just wondering, in looking at it, is there an opportunity for further savings, or at least if we haven't, to get people who would otherwise be eligible for Medicare or Medicaid qualified and on those programs?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Perkins, there are people who are Medicare qualified under the current laws, and basically all inmates become eligible under the Affordable Care Act should it be adopted, but that would be shifted depending on other decisions, either to Medicaid or not. Under the current system, pregnant females and elderly inmates are two subcategories that we could pursue reimbursement for off-site costs. But in looking at the actual amounts of dollars that have been spent on those two populations off-site and the costs of tracking that money, it was pretty much a wash, so we just didn't exert the effort at this point. Should the decision be made to expand Medicaid eligibility and all inmates become eligible, then certainly we would be happy to pursue all off-site costs.
Mr. Chairman, just to follow up on that.
Just a second, Representative Esquibel. Do you have your hand up? Go ahead, Bob.
Could you just explain the, in order for all the inmates to be covered under the ACA, is that something for the expanded provisions, or is it automatic, or just could you explain that to us?
Mr. Chairman, my understanding is should the state decide to expand the Medicaid eligibility, that the prison population is a subset of that.
That would be for all the prisoners then?
Mr. Chairman, sorry, I didn't follow your last question.
So that would be all medical coverage for all incarcerated individuals?
Mr. Chairman, it would be off-site care for anybody who's hospitalized for more than 23 hours, basically. So it has to be a full day of hospitalization, okay. And it has to be off-site.
Okay, Representative Esquibel.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman and Director Lampert. And I was just doing my adding over here. So between July 1st, 2010 and October 31st, 2012, our total costs for medical care were $46.8 million. And I know it's hard for you to be able to predict of what percentage of that total cost the state would show in savings if we were to pay for just exactly what Representative Nicholas asked. That would be my first question, and I know that's going to be a difficult projection. But of the $46.8 million, can you tell me on a percentage basis how much of that is mental health and substance abuse in prison and out of prison? Because we have that program both within the prison system and we have programs outside the prison system.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Esquivel, first of all, in regards to the Medicaid eligibility and what could be saved as a result of that, again, it's off-site costs. So the bulk of our medical costs are for provision of services on-site. Between $3 and $4 million a year has been our cost off-site. So, just for sake of argument, if Medicaid expansion was to take place and it was under the ACA and placed on the feds to pay their share, then my understanding is and originally all of that $3 to $4 million cost, assuming that it was a result of hospitalization, would be picked up under the Medicaid expansion. So there would be some savings there. There's also some cost involved in that, as you all are well aware. In regards to the breakout of health services in the state, the total contracted amount was $40,756,000. Operating expenses was almost $19 million. The services for the doctors was about $4 million. hospitalization accounted for almost $5 million. Outpatient services accounted for about $3 million. Diagnostic services, $1 million. So there's about $10 million in off-site costs as a portion of our current contract. In terms of the costs of medical versus mental health, I don't have the breakout right here of the split out between the mental health and medical, but I think it's about 20% of the medical budget is for mental health care. Our mental health and medical care costs for inmates who are released typically is borne by the individual. While they're under supervision, the state's generally not on the hook, or at least Department of Corrections isn't on the hook for that care. Sometimes they are Medicaid or Medicare eligible, and that's picked up that way. Sometimes they're indigent, and sometimes, like when they're at the ACC, they're on the hook to pay those costs of services because they're earning an income.
Follow-up, Mr. Chairman. Can I get a breakdown of that just in a spreadsheet or something? I just think that there may be questions about this part of your budget, and it's a large part of it. But that's just what you said right now, how you break it down to operating costs, hospital costs, doctor costs, and so
on. Chair. Mr. Co-Chair.
I'll follow up on Representative Escobel. So, Director Lampert, I think I heard you say then about 20% is mental health.
Mr. Chairman.
Of your budget, so $9, $10 million.
Mr. Chairman, the actual amount, I just found it. I don't have a dollar amount, but I have a percentage is 17% of the cost is mental health and mental health prescription costs. So 17% of our contract.
What's that? That's probably $8 million, somewhere in there, ballparking. So I think the question was, at least I was looking for this answer, is how much of that through expansion could be shifted then in the ACA. Has there been any talk of that or analysis of that? Is that what you kind of are at? I thought that's where this was going. I guess that's what I'd like to know.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Co-Chair, that's the cost of in-house mental health treatment.
In-house.
So there's no, basically for there's no off-site mental health costs to us as an agency. As long as they're under our incarceration, we provide the medical health costs and prescription costs. We provide them with 90 days medication upon release, and beyond that, they're on their own for mental health care.
Okay. Well, mm-hmm. I think that. So really the answer was that off-site care is about $3, $4 million, I could possibly be saved.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
Okay.
And Mr. Chairman, and maybe the director knows what my assumption was under the ACA, that off-site, the Medicaid would be picked up regardless of the expansion. So maybe we need to clarify that unless the director knows for certain. So without the expansion, it was my understanding these 24-hour and beyond off-site would be picked up under the ACA.
Would that be out of the woodwork?
Pardon me?
Out of the woodwork is a terminology used by the Department of Health, so that would be where that might come in.
That was my understanding, Mr. Chairman.
I think there's 7,000 people out there that they've identified, and so you would have some of those.
We can confirm that for the committee because that might have some bearing on your decisions.
The question I have is you've got $8 million on-site, off-site. What is that amount off-site that you pay now? None, as I understand it, correct?
Mr. Chairman, for mental health care, we don't have any because
right.
That's on their own. We do have medical costs off-site.
Well, I understand the others like the hospitalization and those,
correct.
But for the substance abuse, mental health, you do not pay any off-site. So when you say there's $3 million worth of savings there through the Medicaid expansion, I'm confused.
Mr. Chairman, that's in regards to the potential savings for our off-site medical costs.
The medical side. Okay, not mental health, substance abuse. Thank you.
This is more of a general discussion, But since we've been talking about mental health and substance abuse, Bob, you and I had talked earlier in the year about trying to find, to see if there was some kind of, if we could correlate any data between the broad expansion of mental health and substance abuse that we've done in Wyoming as a whole, and if that had some, if that had some impact on the leveling off of the increase of the rates of incarceration, the rates of population as we saw them increasing in the Department of Corrections earlier a few years ago. And we had talked earlier, and I'm just wondering, have you found any more data, or have you come to any conclusions if there's a correlation between mental health and substance abuse that's happening in our communities and across our state and its effect on prison population?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Perkins, we're right in the middle of, actually, my understanding of the community mental health centers, they've just moved to a uniform identifier. So that was one of the problems in the past, connecting the people who had gone through the Department of Corrections and tracking their success or not in the community. We're able to do it relative to receiving community mental health services. And so we're actually right now having a discussion with the Wyoming Statistical Analysis Center about a potential study that would look exactly at that, where we would, one portion of it would be to the people that program in prison, follow up with them in the community mental health centers and measure their success related to that. We know how that person does eventually. What we didn't know very well is how many were connected with the mental health centers because of that lack of a common identifier.
Right. Mr. Chairman, if I can just follow up. I think that, and the other one that's going to be harder to find a correlation is just, you know, how many people are not entering the correctional system now, the justice system now, because of the treatment. They haven't committed the crime, or the crime was the drugs, you know, either the drug distribution and possession themselves, or the crimes were committed under the influence of the drug. But anyways, treat that. I mean, because ultimately, if we go back 6 years, we thought that when we finished building the prison in Torrington, that we were probably going to have to start on building another prison. And so now we're talking about whether or not, and if we're going to avoid opening up the other wing of the Torrington prison instead of building an entirely new prison. So, that kind of data, I think, is very helpful, and also may be part of the explanation of why our recidivism rate is so low out of our department as well. And all those things, while I have been, Mr. Chairman, I've been somebody who's been incredibly skeptical about some of the money we spent on mental health and substance abuse, as if these correlations start to come out, it may change my opinion dramatically about how important and vital that is to our state.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Perkins, just two quick comments. First of all, although we still remain at the upper quadrant of the states that have the highest rate of incarceration, the actual rate of incarceration has gone down slightly. Our prison population continues to increase. The percentage of inmates with substance abuse and mental health needs has remained steady. But the population of the state has grown 10% or better. So I think there, just anecdotally, based on those figures, there has to be some impact, but the percentage amount or the actual amount, I don't know, but hopefully the study will give us some of that information. Mr. Chairman, page 30 is another IT consolidation, and our next item for discussion is on page 32. Page 32 provides the information related to the proposed reduction of medical funding at the Wyoming Women's Center in the amount of $1,177,058. I think we had a pretty good discussion already on medical, but if there's no further questions, then I would ask for your concurrence on this item as well. Page 35 is another IT consolidation, and this one's at the Honor Farm in Riverton. The medical funding reduction request for the Honor Farm is contained on page 37. That reduction amount is $1,461,926. And barring any questions on this item, we would again request your concurrence with the governor's recommendation to accept this budget reduction.
What's your population at the Honor Farm, roughly?
Mr. Chairman, As of yesterday, it was 170.
And what's the capacity?
280. And we'll, and I'll provide some testimony on that in a few minutes as well.
Okay.
One of the budget items that comes with a slightly higher risk is on page 40. This budget item involves overtime budget at the Wyoming State Penitentiary in Rawlins. As some of the more tenured members of this committee may recall, filling vacancies and staffing at WSP has been a continuing issue over the years. We've been able to impact the turnover rate at WSP and do a better job of managing overtime dollars these past few years. As a result, we believe we can absorb this reduction without significant risk to safety or operations. With the improving economy, we have seen an upward trend in turnover within the agency and WSP, however. But we still believe we can continue to manage WSP and adequately staff it with the number of staff we have retained, the number of new staff we are recruiting, and the overtime dollars that we would have remaining after this budget reduction. So we would ask that you agree with the governor's recommendation to reduce overtime funding at WSP by $739,367. The risk in doing so is that turnover rate increases and our overtime costs in turn increase beyond what we currently anticipate. That risk is mitigated, however, or at least somewhat, in that we would have vacancy savings because of the increased turnover available to pay the overtime costs if that need arose. Any questions?
Chairman, with respect to that's an interesting dichotomy you just gave us about turnover and overtime rates. But what have you been able to determine is what are the main factors in the increased turnover rate at WSP?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Perkins, just frankly, change in salary structure seems to have had the biggest impact. As you may recall, prior to 2011, we had in place for about 4 years a post-salary scale that basically provided for additional pay increases with increased tenure, increased post-certification levels. Under the new compensation plan that went away, we were able to provide for anybody who had been hired prior to a certain date to provide them those pay increases, but we stopped that. In terms of our attrition rate, we spiked with the number of vacancies with the opening of WMCI. Of course, we had more vacancies, but we had a steady trend downward until 1 year after the stopping of that post-salary scale. Since that time, it's trended upward. We have had a reduction at the end of this year, but anytime we have a new academy, we see a reduction in the number of vacancies because more staff are coming on board. But then after that, it spikes back up. So the overall trend has been upward since we did away with that progressive salary scale.
And, Mr. Chairman, and with respect to the turnover rate, I mean, there's lots of reasons people turn over. Part of it's salary. Part of it is not what they thought it was going to be. But ultimately, is that turnover rate alarming to you? Is it something that needs to be managed, or is this something that you find with correctional officers?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Perkins, it's a national trend in regards to most states that aren't heavily unionized and that you have to be a member of the union in order to be a prison employee are seeing the same trend as us in regards to it's more difficult to attract and retain people in corrections. Part of it has to do with salary. Part of it has to do with just the state of the economy and other job availability. We're not having the success in recruiting. We don't have a when we hired this last academy at the beginning of January, I think we had 14 people. Is that how many names on the list after we hired? We had 14 potential applicants, which is lowest that I can recall in a long time. although the attrition rate, I think we're holding about 17% for the last calendar year overall. So about 17% turnover, which is lower than the 37% that we've seen in the past. But it is trending upward. And so, you know, as the economy continues to improve, as new jobs open up in Carbon County and other areas of the state that pay more, we'll see. And we get our staff are heavily recruited because they're drug-free. They show up for work. They have a stable work history, and the railroad, the other law enforcement are our significant competitors.
Senator Meyer.
Bob, what's the cost for training at the academy? What does it cost you to run a person through?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Meyer, in addition to the cost of salaries, because they're on the clock, we've reduced the amount that it takes to train because we have on-site housing now. And we've, thanks to the budgeting through this Appropriations Committee for the renovation or update of the armory in Rawlins, we now have a good training space. So the costs have come down per person. But, Jeffy, do you know offhand? Ms. Wiggins is indicating that before, when we had to pay for hotel housing, it was about $15,000. In addition to salary, now it's about $3,000 in addition to salary.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Please continue. Yeah. Oh, just Mr. a second. Chairman. Reverend Burkhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bob, how are you staffed right now? Staffing good? You understaffed?
Mr. Chairman, we have 102 vacancies in our agency. About 70 of those are at the pen. It's higher than it's been, but it's probably less than what we've seen in the past in terms of an average. Again, the concern is the trending upward of that in terms of the number of vacancies and the higher difficulty we're having in recruiting new staff. With that said, we've been very successful in some areas recruiting recently people who are returning to Wyoming who were originally from here and have left and now are seeking to come back. So if we can find those people out there, they're ideal candidates because they know what living in Wyoming's like.
Mr. Chairman, so you're down on staff. The budget calls for cutting overtime. I'd have concerns about safety for the community, the inmates, the staff.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Burkhart, as I indicated, there is some calculated risk if the turnover increases. This is we're still feeling that if the current trends continue and we can keep our vacancy or our attrition rate less than 20%, that we'll be okay on overtime. If it goes up beyond that, we have the vacancy savings that are realized to offset those overtime costs. We would have to pay more overtime, but we would use vacancy savings to pay for that additional overtime, even with this budget reduction.
Mr. Chairman. So the 70 vacancies, are they already included in your budget as just open vacancies?
Mr. Chairman, they're in the budget, but I'm not sure of the question. They're funded positions, so they're in the budget.
But okay, Mr. Chairman, so they're funded, so they're just vacant. You haven't eliminated them, though.
Mr. Chairman, that is correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, and on those vacancies, you said 107, 70 at the state pen. What's the time frame? Are most of those short term, or are some of them like over a year? I don't need specifics, but unless you happen to know offhand.
Mr. Chairman, we used to have a very long period of time of vacancies. That's been reduced significantly. Currently, we're running about
20 days. I think what we'd like to have, Bob, on that, since that's a huge number, is maybe give us a follow-up that shows, you know, what that is and where they are and the time. I don't want to create a lot of work. Unless you've got it there, you can answer. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, I do have it here. It varies by job title. For example, electrician, they're very difficult to
hire,
find, and fill. So we've had 400 days without an electrician position. But when we look at correctional officer staffing, we have everything from 32 days. The highest that I see here is about 180 days.
So a big chunk of those are probably just your 17% attrition that you're rolling through the system.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
And what? How many of those 107 would be that? Probably, what, 60, 70 of them? It's 17% of your total number, obviously. So,
In terms of the number of correctional officer vacancies at the Penn, we're around 50. That's increased over the past year from a number that was closer to 20.
But it used to be 37%, so it used to be a lot higher.
Correct.
So we're making progress. Okay. Anything else on this? Continue.
Mr. Chairman, page 42 identifies the reduction of one staff position at the state penitentiary in the amount of $88,277. This is a records technician position that's been frozen, and we've been unable to fill it. The workload has been successfully absorbed for the past 2 years, and its elimination would not have a negative impact on operations. Therefore, we would request your concurrence with this reduction. And also on page 42 is the IT consolidation at WSP. Are any questions on this particular position reduction?
That's your only position. That's the only one that you're reducing, right?
Mr. Chairman,
other
that's
than
correct.
The IT transfer of 14?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. Page 44 is the medical budget reduction at WSP. That's in the amount of $1,081,718. And unless there's additional questions related to medical funding reductions, we would ask for your concurrence on this item as well. Page 47 is another overtime budget reduction, this time at the Wyoming Medium Correctional Institution in Torrington. Our original request for overtime budget at WMCI was built around our experience and history at the Wyoming State Penitentiary in Rawlins. Therefore, we plan for more overtime need than what we've actually experienced at WMCI. Our turnover rates haven't been as high at WMCI as they have been at WSP, and the operational demands for overtime have not been as great. Therefore, we believe we can absorb this proposed reduction of $1,180,633 in overtime funding with minimal impact to operations and safety, and we ask that you concur with the governor's recommendation. Questions? Page 49 is another IT consolidation, and page 51 is WMCI's portion of the reduction in inmate medical care funding. Many of you may know that we built WMCI to be our center of excellence in terms of inmate medical and other treatment needs. The infirmary and specialty housing areas are built to hospital standards, and that means that many of the chronic and advanced medical needs that previously had to go off-site can now be handled on-site using our own providers. That includes things like dialysis and hospice care, for example. That's another reason why our overall medical costs have not escalated as quickly as what was originally anticipated, and why we believe we can safely absorb a reduction of $1,256,664 in this cost unit. We would again request your concurrence and stand for questions on that item. Page 53 outlines our lowest prison-based priority for budget reductions. We gave it the lowest priority, or highest safeguard, if you will, in terms of prioritization, because we see this reduction as coming with the highest short-term and long-term risk and potential costs of any of our efforts. When we developed programming at WMCI and requested program funding to support that institution, we anticipated that we would be able to open and operate a 64-bed transition unit within that facility that would provide for short-term housing and substance abuse and cognitive skills treatment for probationers and parolees who had technical violations of their supervision due to substance abuse and came to prison as a result of those technical violations. The treatment would be provided in an intensive outpatient program and would prepare the offender for return back onto probation or parole so they wouldn't have to complete their term of imprisonment, and so it would result in a shorter-term placement in prison. Thereby, the argument was that we would save bed space and save costs over time. Unfortunately, we were not able to get this program up and running as quickly as what we first hoped to do. So in choosing between cutting funding for proven programs that are already in place and already funded, or cutting the funding for an unopened and unproven program, the choice to us was fairly obvious, that we should remove the money from a program that's not up and operating yet. What's occurred to us since then, however, is that this substance abuse treatment money might also be used in a manner that would more immediately offset costs to the state, and that's where the risk comes in. During my introductory comments, you heard me talk about population projections and the potential need for us to have to build more medium beds in the next biennium. If we didn't have to absorb this particular portion of our budget reduction, we believe we might be able to delay that projected need for construction, and here's why. Although I certainly support the governor and your recognition of a need to reduce government spending, and I recognize that he's my boss, and I go with some risk in talking against his recommendation, I find I must disagree with his recommendation to accept this particular budget reduction in the amount of $1,313,671 for the following reasons. Currently, we're providing in-house intensive residential substance abuse treatment to 144 inmates in two housing units at WMCI. WMCI is a medium custody built and designed facility, including all the beds of that ITU or intensive treatment unit. When we built WMCI and expanded our other existing facilities, we did so based on population projections that were in place prior to 2003. Those projections have proven to be very accurate in terms of our total bed space needs within the agency. What they did not anticipate was that the trend towards increased sentences would actually impact our deployment of inmates within those beds by custody classification. Back in 2003, we thought we were going to have a need for around 527 minimum custody beds at our male minimum custody facilities, and we thought our bed space needs for medium and higher classification for males would be around 1,460, so we built accordingly. However, because of the changing inmate population, we're already experiencing a crunch in the bed space at our medium and high custody facilities and have about 150 to 200 vacant minimum beds that we can't fill due to custody designation and community risk. I think we could reduce the burden on our medium facility beds if we shifted half of our therapeutic community center from WMCI in Torrington and relocated it to the minimum custody relocated it and our minimum custody inmates that are either involved in the intensive treatment program at WMCI at this time or the 100-bed in Casper, and instead locate that facility or that treatment and those inmates at the Honor Farm in Riverton. Doing so would cost us more in terms of contract costs for the substance abuse treatment because it costs more to operate two separate facilities than it does a single facility. And that cost would be in excess of what we're currently funded for substance abuse treatment. However, if we're able to retain the funding targeted by this budget reduction in our budget, or at least a portion thereof, we could make that happen and immediately increase the number of medium custody beds available for housing medium custody and higher classification by 72 beds, and move minimum custody inmates who are at WMCI or the 100-bed treatment facility in Casper to truly minimum beds, so they would be housed and treated according to their classification as minimum inmates rather than having to go to the treatment center either at WMCI, which is medium custody, or to the 100-bed facility in Casper. There is an anticipated cost of doing that, and it's $840,000 per biennium. Therefore, in the interest of being good stewards of the state's dollars and in looking at both the long-term and short-term costs to the state of accepting this budget reduction and continuing to bottleneck the number of inmates that are in medium custody and higher custody beds available to us, which in turn will drive a sooner rather than later request for construction dollars to complete the additional 144 beds at Torrington. I would encourage this committee to consider eliminating this reduction from our budget proposal, or in at least reducing this reduction by $840,000 to a total of $473,671 instead, and authorizing us to retain $840,000 specifically targeted for contracting for the relocation of a portion of our residential substance abuse treatment unit, or ITU, from WMCI to the Honor Farm in Riverton. Doing so would allow us to most economically fill and utilize our minimum custody beds in the agency, would allow us to continue to meet the residential substance abuse treatment needs of our inmate population in a timely fashion prior to release, and would free up beds that can be converted to medium custody, thereby shifting bed space across the agency and gaining medium custody beds for general population use without new construction. Questions?
Yeah, and on that, I think that's pretty substantive, so maybe you could put that together for send it back to us and just go through that, Bob, what you're talking about. The question I have is, if you're going to take 100 out of CASPER that you pay for, and you already have the staff at the Honor Farm, which is there now, so you're going to increase it to 75, you can deal with that the way you're set up now. So aren't there savings realized by the correctional institution in CASPER?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not proposing that we close that contract out. We still need those treatment beds. We still need the 100 beds, but there's minimum custody inmates in that treatment. We could replace those with medium custody or close custody.
Yeah, but if you do that, then you're going to move somebody out of there. Are you saying that you've got others that have to move in there? Maybe you could delay that because you're doing it now anyway.
Mr. Chairman, we currently have 244 beds available to us for residential substance abuse treatment, intensive treatment. 100 of those are at CASPER under contract. 144 are at WMCI. What we're proposing is that we shift 72 of those beds to the Honor Farm. We still have 244 beds for treatment, but those 72 beds that are vacated at Torrington as a result of the move would then be truly general population medium custody, no longer tied up by treatment beds. So we would still have the same total number of treatment beds. Our minimum inmates would go to the Honor Farm for treatment. The others would either go to the 100 bed in CASPER or to Torrington for treatment.
Okay, well, just put that together. I understand what you're saying, but it just seems to me if you're going to put 75 to the Honor Farm, there's got to be a gap in as it moves through the system. But maybe you're already staffed up and you really can't do any reductions on the other end of it, and I can understand that. But that's something we ought to know and understand, so please put that together for us. Senator Perkins?
Quick question. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Also, when you're putting that together, I understand you said about $7 to $9 million for building out the wing. And you said you need about 30 staff members?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
We need the cost on what that would be.
We need the cost of staff members because, you know, my experience is that the cost of staff very quickly divorces the cost of facilities.
Mr. Chairman, we'll put that together.
Okay. The other thing, too, while we're doing that is on the parole side and the parole board's next, but, you know, obviously that's one of the things that I'd like to have. Maybe they'll provide that number, is how many were paroling. The recidivism is going down, yet the population's going up, and I understand those numbers. And so, Senator Meyer.
I guess the other question I've got is that rather than spending the $840,000, is there any place out there or any facilities that we can privately contract for this placement, or is that possible in any way?
Mr. Chairman, there's currently nothing constructed that I'm aware of in the state that could provide for that. In addition, there is a real cost savings in terms of these are vacant beds at the Honor Farm. We're already staffed at the Honor Farm, but the inmates aren't there. This would actually shift inmates to where the bed space is, at the same time freeing up bed space in the custody classifications that we need. So it's a way to manage our total bed space population, which we have at least 300 vacant beds in our prisons, but it's all located, the majority of them are located in minimum facilities. So we need to figure out a way to fill our minimum facilities and reduce the backlog or the squeezing in our medium and high custody facilities.
Yeah, and this is pretty substantive, and, you know, put that together. I don't know how long it'll take for you to do that, but get it back to us as quickly as you can, and and maybe the committee may want you to come back and just specifically speak to that. We'll see how that goes when we do it, because that I can see some savings potentially there, and I think we need to understand a little bit better. So, okay, we're going to – any quick questions?
Yeah, just quickly.
We're running out of time, so make them quick.
It's my understanding and from earlier visits during last year that part of the problem of putting people in the CAC and moving them to Riverton has to do with your definition of what minimum and medium and high security inmates are, and the programs that you put them through or require them to go through before you transfer them from medium to minimum security. Is that a fair representation?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nicholas, our classification takes into account risk, both community risk and institutional risk, and assigns people according to that risk. What we're seeing is that we're getting a riskier population for whatever reason. 25% of our population is sex offenders. That escalates the risk factor some. So because of that risk factor not matching with what we projected out as the number of beds, that's what's created the vacancies.
So in essence, you objectively or subjectively create the risk factors, and based upon those factors as they come in, you qualify them as medium or minimum, and then establishes their placement. And the fact, and based upon your criteria, then you have less beds available in Torrington and more beds available in Riverton.
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. We have a classification system that's well tested and normed to Wyoming population, and for every time we adjust that, we take a, you know, if we move people that currently don't qualify for minimum custody to a minimum custody facility, there's a calculated, proven risk that comes with that. For example, if we move somebody who has a detainer, which we don't allow to go to minimum facility, to a minimum facility, and they know they're going to a new sentence after completion, they become an enhanced escape risk. We have that actually calculated out in terms of what that risk factor is. And frankly, I've absorbed as much risk as I can and feel comfortable in my job. And overall, it's about community safety. And when those community safety factors and the risk to community safety goes up as a result of transferring somebody, I'm hesitant to do that.
Okay, one more quick one, Don, and then we're going to move on.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick request, Director. How have you developed a process to fill these staffing shortfalls? Do you have a plan to do it, and could you share it for us? You don't have to give it to us now. I'm looking for 1 to 3 pages and no more.
Mr. Chairman, we can put a recruiting plan document together, and certainly we have that, but the pools have dried up for the most part. The Michigans and the other areas where we've been successful in recruiting aren't as in dire straits as they once were. So we continue to track that across the nation and go to those places. And again, my hope is that we'll see more and more people who were born and raised in Wyoming coming back to Wyoming. And that's where our bread and butter would be if we can locate those individuals.
Okay, we're going to shut this down. I think there might be a call back out there. The one concern I have, and I didn't get into it, is, you know, all of these reductions you're talking about can't be biennialized. I think 9.8 million cannot. And if we move forward, you got another $11 million worth of reductions we're talking about. And so I don't know where we're going to find this, but let's talk about that later. Okay, thank you very much. We appreciate it. Pearl, real quick, like, we are going to get you done in the next 7 minutes, I hope. Please come forward.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Chair, Co-Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Pat Anderson. I'm the Executive Director of the Wyoming Board of Parole. With 7 minutes to go, I'll make this quick. My board consists of 7 members who travel around the state to prisons and make the decision whether or not to release inmates onto community supervision. Why is this important? There's a couple of reasons. Number one is we believe that the parole system provides inmates and offenders with the best opportunity to reform, to rehabilitate, and to reverse the cycle of recidivism. Just very quickly, Department of Corrections provided us with some data last year which indicated that of all inmates who discharge their sentences, they finish up in prison, 33% come back within 3 years back into DOC custody, either due to a misdemeanor or a felony. That's different than the statistics Mr. Lampert gave you earlier. For parolees who discharge their sentence on parole, the rate is half of that. So about 15% of parolees come back within 3 years to the Department of Corrections on misdemeanor or felony. The other reason this is important, and we don't like to brag about it because it's not really the board's mission, it doesn't guide the board's decisions, but the reality is, the result of the board's work is that we have 600 offenders out in the community who would otherwise be in DOC facilities. The cost of housing an inmate now for DOC is $55,000 a year. Cost of supervision in the community is approximately $7 per day. So we figure with about 600 parolees in the community, the state is being saved the cost of running another prison, $35 million in actual housing costs, and not including the capital construction costs. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'll go to our budget.
Please. Go right to page 7, would you?
I would be glad to do that. And we'll quickly outline the cuts that we proposed. And it's obvious, I believe, but you will note that the governor recommended against imposing any cuts on us. The first cut was from the some funds that we received, $2,500 a year for matching funds to match Victim Services Division grants that we received to reimburse victims for the cost of traveling to meet with the board. Those funds are no longer needed because we now receive the funding from Division of Victim Services from the victim surcharge, for which no matching funds are required. Next was the 900 series professional fees. We had $10,000 in the biennial budget, and we proposed to give back $5,000. These funds were initially intended for the board to utilize to obtain psychosexual evaluations for sex offenders. We weren't consistently receiving those from the Department of Corrections, and the board wanted to dig in deeper before it made the tough decision whether to let a sex offender back into the community. Since then, sporadically, the DOC has had contracts for sex offender treatment services, which did include these evaluations. It's my understanding they may be funded again for such services in the future, or currently are funded, excuse me, and so we just don't need that money anymore. $7,000 to come out of Object Code 207, dues and registrations, and we propose to reduce that fund by $7,000 by eliminating annual training conferences that the board members attend each year. Also to cut back on some staff tuition assistance that we have been providing for college-level courses for one of our staff members. So that's how we would make that cut. The biggest source of funds available to cut, aside from personnel 100 series, is our travel budget. Object Code 222 out-of-state, 221 in-state travel. Aside from running the administrative functions within our office, our real expense, besides salary, is paying for the board to travel twice a month throughout the year for 24 hearings a year to DOC facilities all over the state to conduct hearings. The method of travel that we have utilized since the 1980s has been the governor's or the state airplanes, and we currently use the state jets to travel to hearings. We did a cost-benefit analysis of how much money we could save by driving to those hearings instead of flying, and found that we could have a net savings of approximately $1,500 per hearing, and that is because we have to take additional time to travel. We have to pay additional salary to the members. We still have to pay them mileage. We have to pay additional per diem and lodging expenses for them to travel by vehicle. However, we found...
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, we did calculate that by driving to half of our hearings in fiscal year 14, we could save enough money for the state to make the 8% cut.
Okay, we're going to wrap this up because we got to get going. The thing I would ask you to do And I, you know, I have not participated in physically myself in one of those hearings, but it seems to me that if you have a lot of these hearings or people that have been in front of you before, and it's pretty clear that they're probably not going to get their parole, but by whatever reason they have to be able to come in front of you and plead their case. And I'm just thinking, instead of all these meetings, maybe you could look at a way to cut them in half and do some of it with video or something, some other way to do that. I don't know what other states are doing. And maybe it's just crazy and not a good idea, but could you look into that for us? Because I think there's got to be some better ways to do that. I'm not concerned. You know, if you got to go, let's fly and let's get there because time's valuable. But maybe we don't need as many meetings, and that's where I'm headed. See what you can come up with on that.
That's the question. The 24, is that somehow mandated? Why couldn't it be 12? I guess that's a.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Harshman, the reality is we have to see the inmates annually to consider a parole.
Yeah, but do you have to see them personally?
We don't, and we have done the analysis, and we have looked into video hearings, and essentially the board believed that there was a cost to be paid for doing them by video. We actually did a test run by video, and they felt that they didn't get the same degree of interaction necessary to really dig in and do the best they can to determine whether somebody's really rehabilitated and sincere about going out and having, you know, a law-abiding life if they're released. And the governor agreed with that.
Okay. Okay. Would you consider that? And with that, we'll be back at 3 o'clock. And members of the Senate, we're going to meet at the Senate S-13, Patsy S-13, just about like 12:30. We got one bill. We're just going to – it's all set to go when we approve it already, but I want to talk about it. Thanks.